You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate on this beautiful Thursday afternoon. Since the Victorian era, taxidermists have been both revered and reviled for the work they do, arranging animal skins on armatures to try to breathe the illusion of life into the dead. In her new book, Still Life, Adventures in Taxidermy, Melissa Milgram explores this world of breathless life, from the dioramas at the American Museum of Natural History to the animals on game hunters' mantles and the art gallery. Still Life is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm pleased that it brings Melissa Milgram to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So why taxidermy? What brought you to the world of taxidermy?
I think writers and artists like to go where they're not supposed to go. And I had a big curiosity for taxidermy after I'd gone on a safari in Tanzania and wandered into a hunting camp and saw skin pelts for the first time. And I thought, what could be more ludicrous than taking an animal and turning it into a replica of itself?
So in Africa, did they look like a replica? What did they look like hanging
up? No, these
up?
Were just hunters' kills. You know, they were salted pelts hanging there. And it was really horrific for somebody like me, who's from New Jersey, where I don't see wildlife in general, much less, you know.
It usually has big furry tails and about 8 inches long.
Well, I know about squirrels.
Yes, exactly.
So when I came back home, I had this curiosity and I wandered into this taxidermy shop that everybody knew about because it's been there since the 1920s.
In a town, was this in your town or in a town nearby?
1 mile from where I grew up, in Milltown, New Jersey.
So you went to Africa to find something that was right around the corner from you.
Yeah, isn't that ironic?
What did you find when you walked into this shop? It sounds like from reading your book, it took you a while to actually get into the shop because there was a little bit of a concern about questions and
well,
who you might be.
Well, I certainly hesitated because, you know, nothing has more stigma than taxidermy. I mean, it's not even included in outsider art fairs. And you think of Norman Bates, you think of tacky jackalopes, which, you know, I like, but the connotations are so negative that even though I happened to stumble into a wonderful taxidermy shop, I was nervous at first, and the smells and the sights and the tools. But the shop I wandered into was the Schwendemanns, and they have been affiliated with the American Museum of Natural History since the 1940s. So it was a taxidermic gold mine, and it felt more like falling into Darwin's study.
What were the people inside that shop like? Tell us about that family.
Well, it's a wonderful family, three generations of taxidermists, and they're proud to be taxidermists. Unlike a lot of taxidermists who face a lot of prejudice, they're always really proud. David Schwendemann, who's now 85 and who was the last taxidermist to work on staff at the museum, is a gentle bird watcher. He's like a Victorian field naturalist. And his son, Bruce, has a master's degree in zoology, and he continues running the firm. And in fact, he calls himself a taxidermologist to distinguish himself from the people who, say, mount white-tailed deer in their basements. Not that they're not good taxidermists, but what he does is completely and utterly scientifically accurate.
You write about David's parents who lived into, well, his mother lived into her 90s, and David describes her cutting an apple with a knife that had just been dipped in arsenic and she just wiped off on her apron, and that they really believed that arsenic was a key to her longevity. Is arsenic one of the tools that the taxidermists used?
Well, arsenic was used as a preservative and insecticide
and
for
I'm
many
not,
years.
I'm not advocating that people should be taking
arsenic
for long life. No, no, no.
But it's a deadly carcinogen.
Yes.
But since taxidermists defend their profession no matter what, because they're used to it being so maligned, that the Schwendemanns even defended arsenic, and they believed that Lillian, her name was, but they call her Mum-Mum, which I love, Mum-Mum the Skinner.
Who skinned a bear, right?
She skinned everything. She was a skinner, and she made the artificial ears, too, and she's quite a character, and she lived until she was 92, and they believed that she had metabolized arsenic, and that's why she lived so long. And in fact, a British zoologist did a study comparing the lifespans of Victorian taxidermists and their civilian counterparts and found that the taxidermists outlived the civilians by some 40 years.
And this was when life expectancy was like 35 years.
Exactly.
Right? So to
I'm not advocating it, but who
well,
knows?
Well, whether it's taxidermy or arsenic, but neither, I think. Well, taxidermy maybe, but arsenic, no, we probably shouldn't be imbibing. But what did you find your own reactions were to this shop where, I mean, you write about people covered in brains and blood and using something called a brain spoon, the various chemicals and tools all have names that for most of us elicit kind of a ugh.
Right, like tail splitters. At least you know what they do. They're descriptive. And the Schwendemanns make their own tools and pass them down from generation to generation. But again, that made me feel like I was back in the Victorian era. It just seemed like the heyday of natural history was alive in the shop. So once you get past all the gore and blood, and I know that's the most sensational aspect, but it's really not the most important part of this topic.
You also, in addition to looking at animals preserved for natural history museums, you see game hunters, and you also go into the art world with Damien Hirst's, I was going to say embalmer, but it's really taxidermist.
Uh-huh.
Damien Hirst is the artist known for sharks in art galleries swimming in formaldehyde and cows split down the middle. What did you find when you met with the woman who works with him?
Well, Emily Mayer is an English sculptor, but she began as a taxidermist at age 12. She's from Greenwich, urban background, but her parents were artists, so they nurtured her love of taxidermy and animals. Emily is, actually the New York Times described her as a Tim Burton-esque perfectionist, and I agree with that entirely because she's as fascinated with an animal that isn't alive as much as one that is alive, and she pushes realism farther than anyone else I've met in the taxidermy world.
How does she do that? What are her tools, and what are the ways that she pushes that?
Well, she has a technique called erosion molding, where the hair alone is embedded into silicon rubber and the rest of the body is rotted away. And again, you can't get away from this gross stuff. But the results are so perfect, so uncanny, that her dogs fool her pet dogs. Her cast dogs are... She
sets them up and then has her own real dogs come up and sniff them and they're fooled?
Well, they do it on their own and they curl up and fall asleep with her cast foxhound because they're that uncanny.
And is it the hair? I mean, that sounds like an interesting detail that you could painstakingly kind of paste or glue onto the...
No, it's actually the expression. And American taxidermists refuse to mount pets these days because they can't get the expression right, and especially the expression of a pet that someone once loved. Now, Emily loves the challenge of getting it right. And the best taxidermists, from Carl Akeley at the American Museum of Natural History in the 20s, to Ken Walker, another taxidermist I write about in my book, to the Schwendemanns, they have this obsession to get it right. But Emily will only preserve dogs for grieving owners who can't get over it. She tries to talk them out of it, and when they really can't, and they're mourning deeply, then she'll do it, and she won't charge them.
So getting it right, it seems, has subtle differences between the various people that you write about. For the Schwendemanns, it's really, you write about the difference between a zebra and this particular zebra, making sure that the animal has a kind of individuality.
Right, and that's the difference between a museum scientific specimen, it would be that zebra, the one they photographed in Africa, versus a trophy, which would be a generalized depiction. And another thing this brings me to, taxidermy is either, when you get it right, it's accurate, and then if you get something wrong, it's a distortion. So it's almost like a taxidermist can't win, because if they're doing it right, it's just accurate. It's not like wonderful. I mean, it is wonderful, but you know what I mean.
It just is what it was.
Right, and the eye can pick up the slightest distortion, and that's what makes taxidermy seem creepy, because you don't have to know why it's wrong to know it's wrong.
Yeah, there was a story actually on the media that I was just talking about today about this in animation where there's this thing that they call the uncanny valley, and it's that space between reality and something you know that's not real, and if you know it's not real but it looks real, it totally freaks you out, and you have to either push it you have to push it towards the unreal. And right. Is that true with taxidermy too? Is there a kind of sense if it's too real, it's
yes,
unnerving?
Say the dioramas are so beautiful, and they sort of glamorize the most wonderful moments in nature, and that's fortunate because they don't exist anymore out in the world. Or I'm exaggerating, but we go to the museum to experience nature at its best.
Well, also in the world, they change moment by moment. I mean, here you go into the museum and it's captured and it's a narrative for you at that moment. And you know, when you come back in 6 months or 6 years, it's going to be that same moment. Nature is not like that.
Not at all, especially with mankind coming in and trampling all of our wilderness areas. But
I know you write also about the people judging little taxidermy tableau for that kind of narrative, for being able, through the way the birds look at each other, to tell a story.
Well, the Victorians loved this anthropomorphic tableau, and there was a Victorian taxidermist, Mr. Walter Potter, whose Museum of Curiosities was auctioned off in 2003, and I write about it in the book, and I believe that that collection would have survived if had it been auctioned off in 2005 when taxidermy was cool again. But
what changed between 2003 and 2005?
I don't know. Taxidermy goes through cycles of being reviled and loved, and it's never midway. But I think really what's at the core of it is that animals have become exotic again as they become extinct. And for the Victorians, it was the same thing, only in reverse. Animals were exotic because they had never seen these species before. And I think it's the same amateur love of nature. And taxidermists have always been amateur lovers of nature. And that's, again, brings us back to those anthropomorphic scenes that Walter Potter did of kittens dressed as brides and dueling squirrels and the bespectacled lobsters. I love this stuff. But one thing I didn't realize before I wrote the book is that their love of animals was so pure that, and they had no irony back then, that anthropomorphism is actually a good thing. Like, I thought, when I started my book, I thought it was kind of sappy.
And you saw kittens dressed as brides.
Well, yeah. I didn't see that before. These are some kittens.
You actually ventured into taxidermy yourself. Tell us about your squirrel.
Well, I did mount a squirrel. The Schwendemanns guided me through the whole process.
How did you get your squirrel? What was the first
David
step?
David Schwendemann got the squirrel for me. He was trapping for gophers and caught a squirrel instead. So he got the squirrel, and then it was very difficult to mount. In fact, the Schwendemann said, How did you talk us into this? Why couldn't you choose something easier, like a bear?
Because it's so little.
Yeah, it has all these little details and the whiskers and the claws. And a real taxidermist, a diehard taxidermist, would actually remove all the whiskers and reinsert them individually to create a mood. But I am not a real taxidermist.
I have to say, I just had to get that out. Maybe it's not so bad. I was not good at biology either. So
when you go to the Museum of Natural History and look at the dioramas, every bit of anatomy supports the biological narrative. So you have to know a lot about
animals. And you have to be, as you say, accurate. You have to do it in the way that supports this rather than, because lots of school children might think, oh, that's what a squirrel looks like.
Right. And also, if you want to convey fear and give your animals emotion and show how they really interact in their habitats, which is what dioramas capture, it has to be realistic. So their ears, you know, the hunting dogs, one of my favorite dioramas, those perked ears are sensing danger. It all plays a role.
So with your squirrel, were you trying to be accurate in that way? Was there something you wanted to convey?
Well, mine is an urban squirrel because I was drawing from my environment, my New York City environment. And I actually created a little diorama around it. It was racing across a telephone wire, and I competed with it.
I've seen that very often, yes.
Yeah, and I competed with it in the World Taxidermy Championships and took a second place ribbon in novices.
Well, congratulations. We only have a minute left, but I know you brought some show and tell. It's radio, so you're going to have to describe what it is you brought with you, but these are some of the tools of the trade.
Right. Well, in the Victorian era and even today, the diehard taxidermists make all their anatomy from scratch, but I'm holding a little tube of jaw juice, which is artificial saliva, and here's a bobcat.
So if you
jaw.
Have a fox that's about to eat something and you
exactly.
want to make it look rapacious, you just use this artificial, it's jaw juice.
Jaw juice, all the way, yep. And just one of the many marvels of taxidermy.
Of modern taxidermy. And then you also have
a bear nose, and you could see all the detail. But again, the people who I write about in my book, they make every scrap of anatomy by hand because they want to experience nature on its own term, on their own terms.
And are these parts that you can't keep from the animal itself, a nose, or and that's why you have to have a fake one?
Well, it's easier. I mean, look at all the fine detail. It would be easier just, that's why like the Schwendemans call it model making, because you could just buy all the parts and put it together. But if you really, like Emily Mayer, will spend 5 days mixing colors for cow hooves to get it right for one of Damien's sculptures, because she will not be satisfied unless it's real.
Well, my guest has been Melissa Milgram. She has written a book about taxidermy called Still Life, Adventures in Taxidermy. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. We'll be right back.